Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Chris Bernor.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
How you guys doing? Chris Bernor, we have not heard from you in such a long time. You've been kind of busy with your own sort of startup.
Yeah, I've been living in the startup cave for the last probably 2.5 months. We started with at the beginning of January, sort of putting on our first sort of real first batch of customers. And you know, the thing about customers is they want features, they want it to stay working, they want
those pesky customers
support. Like, what is it with them?
Yeah, what is it with people?
Yeah. And then we also hired a new engineer, so I'm actually spending a lot more time managing the team and everything too. But it's super exciting. We're doing really well. It's this is the real thing. I sort of came out to Silicon Valley to do a startup, and here I am. But it's a lot of work. It's definitely not like in the movie where you just spend all your time, you know, partying with Sean Penn.
Well, I remember, you know, scenes from The Social Network. It wasn't the Mark Zuckerberg character, but all of his buddies were like in the room, hovered over their laptops, like, you know, nonstop coding. So
he's in the zone. Yeah, that's me. That's me. But it's pretty cool. It's pretty exciting. Got like a real architecture now. Like, I actually have a small army of servers now that do my bidding, as opposed to just, you know, one. It's pretty exciting. So I'll keep you guys posted when we have sort of more like news to raise. There will definitely be some in the next few months. But awesome. It's good to be back on the show. Nerding it up in a different way.
It's great to have you. Hopefully we can get you on here more often. You know, as I don't know, hopefully I'm hoping it'd be nice to get you on in the frequency that you were on before you became all, you know, rich and powerful and famous.
Oh yeah, I'd love to do that. The last couple months are somewhat unique. I can't keep up this pace any longer than anybody else can. And I want to be doing some other stuff outside of startups. So yeah,
this week the White House chimes in on cell phone unlocking. Samsung's new phone watches you watching it. YouTube takes on Spotify. Microsoft gets its wrist slap. 6 strikes and you're out. Han, Luke, and Leia come back for Star Wars 7. And I, for one, welcome our new cinderblock hurling overlords. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. I wasn't going to do a What We're Playing With segment this week, but I have to do it because yesterday I got a thin brown box in my mail, and on the outside of the box it just said, "It's time." So I opened it up, and lo and behold, there is my Pebble watch, the second Kickstarter project that I had ever funded. And finally arrived. As people may or may not be familiar with, Pebble was a project started on Kickstarter by a group of people who had already done a watch that connects with your Android. This is basically it's the watch that integrates with your iPhone and allows you to get messages, SMS messages, and other notification alerts on the face of the phone. On the face of the watch, in addition to allowing you to sort of change watch faces by remote by a iPhone app, and also control your music through the watch as well.
So have you had a chance to play around with it and sort of see the way it changes your workflow? Because that's the thing I've heard about the Pebble, is that like it really changes the way you interact with your phone, because it's not your phone anymore, it's your watch.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing for sure, and it's kind of, I mean, it feels silly to mention this because I certainly didn't need a iPhone connected device to do this, but I no longer have to pull my phone out of my pocket to see what time it is. I just look at my wrist watch. But for
so
sure,
futuristic.
Yeah, I know. So cutting edge, so 21st century. But for sure, I get to see who's texting me, answer or ignore calls if I need to. I could just hit a button on the side to have the call go to message. There are a number of other functions that I have not yet played with. I just got it yesterday, and it's just kind of in the initial sort of phases, but I have played with all the sort of watch faces and some of the rudimentary functions, like the music, being able to switch music, which is really nice. And on your wrist is the a list of the song and the artist and the album. So just really nice device. It's sleek, it's futuristic looking, and I love I love it so far. The best thing about it is that these guys are not resting on their laurels. They're going to keep developing for it and open up, for other people to develop for it as well.
Huh.
So very positive first reaction, first experience.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the first Kickstarter, we've talked about this on the show before as well. The first Kickstarter that I funded, I'm incredibly disappointed about, because I'm never going to get that money back. And that is a company who was building basically Google Glass, but not with all the Google functionality, just a camera in a pair of glasses that looks realistic, that looks like a real pair of glasses and not like a camera. So that I have not heard from those guys, and so I'd probably never see that money again. But this, as a second sort of Kickstarter project, this I'm very happy about this.
So what is it like wearing a watch again? Because like I used to wear a watch for years and years and years, and honestly, ever since I got a cell phone, I just didn't see the point anymore, because it was like, does that feel weird? Like, I mean, there's a lot of rumors of like Apple doing an iWatch or whatnot.
Right, the slap bracelet watch. Yeah, no, it's a little weird. But ironically enough, like the last watch that I wore before I stopped wearing watches was also a network connected watch. I think it was made by Fossil, and I think it connected via, I don't know if it was Wi-Fi or through some sort of network, and it would deliver news alerts and everything as well. And that was a few years ago, so that was kind of cutting edge at the time. Those particular type of watches fell out of style, and they've now been replaced by it's kind of like the tablet. The tablet, some people came out with these cutting edge tablets, and then everyone sort of dissed on the whole tablet form factor as a whole, and then Apple came out with the iPad, and then then it became popular again. And same goes with this, the watch that I had before, that Fossil watch with the alerts. It was cutting edge at the time, but no, it didn't gain adoption, and no one bought network connected watches. And now I think it's going to start to make a comeback again with the Pebble and with the Apple's futuristic slap bracelet watch, whatever that is going to be.
Yeah, that could be exciting. Hopefully.
Let me ask you guys, because you guys also mentioned things that you were playing with this week. And Chris, I'll start with you. What are you playing with this week?
Well, I think I may have mentioned these guys before, but they were sort of very early stage at this point. Speaking of Kickstarter, good transition there, Andy. So one of the unfortunate problems of Kickstarter is that it's been very successful in the sort of like artistic world, where you basically fund a documentary or a short film or a book or something, and almost by virtue of funding it, you're guaranteed to get it. There is this problem in the sort of more hardware world where an awful lot of projects on Kickstarter have been successfully funded and then you never get anything. So one of my classmates at First Floor Labs, where my incubator that we're in, it's called Swish.com. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to solve that by making a Kickstarter-like experience, but specifically focused on hardware and specifically focused on pre-orders. So when companies sign up to be on Swish, they are contractually obligated to send you what they order. And a matter of fact, like, the money that is raised is actually held in escrow until they do it. So, like, this is for serious companies that are already in the business, already, like, creating awesome things, but who want to basically validate that their ideas are worth doing before they come out. They got quite a collection of really cool devices, games. There's a really cool game called Disruptus that we've been playing at work a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like a couple other watches and everything. It's a cool experience. I really recommend checking it out. It's called Swish, Swish. I haven't been playing with too much else, but I would highly recommend taking a look at that.
Cool. And Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
I've been playing with a couple things. The first thing which I'll mention is for a while I was looking for a network storage device to have locally to run all my backups and basically just have as a disaster recovery in case any of my hard drives died. I recently had issues with one of my SSDs. So I picked up a Netgear Pro 4, a ReadyNAS Pro 4, mm-hmm. Because it had four bays. So far, it's actually really cool. It's the quietest computer I have at home. It's got a lot of features and functionality. You know, four bay. So I have currently I have 2 3-terabyte drives in there. So it's kind of like a RAID 1 configuration where they're mirrored. But ReadyNAS has this RAID configuration called X-RAID, which allows you to basically hot swap and add additional drives on the fly. So I've been working on configuring it, and right now I have scheduled backups, which basically pull data from my computer onto this external storage and also emails me if there are any issues. So it's pretty cool. You can use it both for that, but you can also use it for media streaming as well as for any sort of legal torrenting. It's pretty impressive. But I would have to say the game changer that I've been playing with lately is this app called Mailbox for iOS. Have you guys heard of it?
You got it? I'm on the waiting list.
Yes, so I did. I got it last Sunday or so, or maybe the Sunday before, and it is seriously a game changer in the way that I think and function with mail. I was talking to our CEO, Aaron Levy, about it at a recent occasion prior to getting it and asking him. I was like, I've been waiting for so long. Is it really worth the wait? And he was like, yes, it is. And I concur. So for me, when I deal with mail and it only connects to Gmail currently, but when I dealt with Gmail, for the longest time, I actually never archived mail. Like, I would mark it as read, of course, and it wouldn't have anything which existed in the inbox, but I would always keep it in that view. I never would move it to the all mail view. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing. The dynamic of this app is it looks at the world in terms of, you know, you really want to get to this zero point where you have a clean inbox. And it actually rewards you for having a clean inbox because there's a little image at the very back, which once you have a clean inbox, you can click on it and you get to see basically an image from some web resource where, you know, someone took this attractive image as your background.
Uh-huh.
So I think typically it fluctuates where it's from. For example, today's image I think is from Instagram, just a really cool Instagram image of like a tunnel. And but anyway, the dynamic which they're really going for is this zero inbox sum. And for me, you know, what I'd always do is I'd make to-do lists in Gmail and get through my workday. Mm-hmm. But now I've federated everything in Mailbox, and simply with a swipe, I can perform actions on my mail. And I use my inbox really as a location for the items that I need to get done at this moment. So if it's something that I simply, you know, I have this message which includes topics that I need to cover for a training, well, maybe I will delay it for a few hours. And I can automatically delay that. So it's out of sight, out of mind until I need to actually deal with it. So it's, I think it's kind of a really unique dynamic because, for one, it's this seamlessly clean and aesthetically pleasing build. Mm-hmm. It's simple to use with a UI, but also it gets you into this strategy of getting things done in an organized fashion and, you know, not letting your to-do list grow to an absorbent length. Because that's what I find that happens. I keep adding things to the to-do list. I do deal with some of them, but there's stuff which is there for, you know, ages. And it becomes unwieldy. So I think hold the course. And yes. When you get this app, I would love to hear your opinions of it. But I think you're going to really love it.
I can't wait.
Yeah. I signed up for another app, which looked like it's a similar type. It's called Tempo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm on the waiting list for them too.
Yeah, one of our VCs recommended it, and I think it's finally speeding up as of like today.
Uh-huh.
Because literally, I thought I was going to wait for like a few months before I get this one.
It says from the makers of Siri, this Tempo app.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what that means. Because I mean, the makers of Siri would be Apple.
Well, Siri was purchased by Apple, so it was whoever it was that was developing Siri before they Apple mm-hmm. purchased them.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm 1800 in line. So wow, that's really good.
Wow.
Yeah, it's up.
The other way around. I'm 32,000 in line. Never mind, I got that wrong. So excited!
All right.
So what do you guys think of this new sort of trend in mobile Git development where you download something and then you get basically a countdown?
You know, I'll be honest with you. It feels a little faddish to me. You know, it's building demand, but I think it's building demand almost in a gimmicky sort of way. But I'm not sure how else an app developer is going to handle the situation where they can't roll out an app to enough people who want it. It mm-hmm. seems like a logical way to do it, but it does have sort of a gimmicky feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, they do purposefully make it gimmicky to a certain extent too, because with a lot of those apps, they also include options to tweet about it, to, you know, send notifications on Facebook underneath.
I'm really enjoying this countdown.
Yeah, exactly. It really makes you I've faced that dilemma where I'm just debating with regards to, you know, how much of it is actually needing to slow down the rollout and how much is it in trying to build some PR. Yeah. Because on one hand, you are building PR, but on the other hand, for example, the Tempo app, I see quite a lot of negative reviews, and that's purely just from people who are not satisfied having to wait to get the app. So I wonder. I really do wonder. And go ahead.
I do. I mean, there is a lot to be said for building up a good support model, like, early on, you know. Like, I mean, as I was just joking, you know, at the beginning of this episode, even when you have a sort of small beta group of customers, like, it does sort of take off time from development. And yet at the same time, you don't want to be developing in a hole for, you know, a long time. And especially if you're, like, a relatively, like, high-profile group, you know, like the people who made Siri and know how to market yourself really well, that certainly, you know, like you're going to get way more people interested in you than you can support early on. That being said, I don't know. I'm not sure. I have this feeling that, like, it's just simply not going to work too long. Like, eventually people are just going to – it's going to be too common, right? And then people are just going to get pissed off. Like, these are kind of interesting because they seem like a big deal. But you simply cannot make every single application that you download there have some sort of, like, oh, you need to get in line.
It reminds me of when you had to sign up for, like, Google Mail and you you got it and they were going you'd suddenly be, you know, gifted Google Mail. Here it is. And you get like two or three, ten shares to share with your friends to get them on board too. That kind of thing. It's just a little gimmicky. But
yeah. Remember when people were selling...
Oh yeah!
Email accounts.
Oh yes, that was crazy. anyway, so let's get into headlines here. The White House on Monday came out in support of the rights of consumers to unlock their cell phones once they've fulfilled the terms of the contract. Responding to a petition on whitehouse.gov, the executive branch said that we agree with the 114,000 plus of you who believe that consumers should be able to unlock their cell phones without risking criminal or other penalties. They went further saying that the same right should also extend to mobile devices, namely tablets. And if you've paid for your mobile device and aren't bound by service agreement or other obligation, you should be able to use it on another network, wrote R. David Edelman, White House Senior Advisor for Internet Innovation and Privacy. It's common sense, crucial for protecting consumer choice, and important for ensuring we continue to have the vibrant, competitive wireless market that delivers innovative products and solid service to meet consumers' needs. Now, the librarian of Congress, who has authority over the matter, ruled last October that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act should be interpreted to mean that unauthorized cell phone unlocking was a violation. As of January 26, we discussed this on the show, newly purchased phones can no longer legally be unlocked. Now, whitehouse.gov is not a the petition part of the site is not a lawmaking body in itself. So where do we go from here? They responded that the Obama administration would support a range of approaches to addressing the issue, including narrow legislative fixes in the telecommunications space that make it clear neither criminal law nor technological lock should prevent consumers from switching carriers when they're no longer bound by a service agreement or other obligation. So there we have the official White House position on that matter, which I think is a good place to go from here. Even if they can't legally do anything about it until other people step in and start to make laws.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, sort of policy wise, that the Librarian of Congress or the Librarian. What is it?
The Librarian of Congress.
Who presumably is appointed by the executive branch.
Right.
Would not be against this, and then the administration would be. But it's pretty cool, I must admit. I'm glad that the administration is sort of observing, like, what has sort of become commonplace now. I mean, yeah. It seems odd that after 10 years of this being legal, it would suddenly become not legal. Like, I don't understand how that works, especially once now that there is, you know, a very vibrant unlocking community.
Right. Well, you know, the Librarian of Congress, we talked about it before on the show. They had always been of the position that it shouldn't be legal, and we were just basically on amnesty until they decided that the law should be enacted so that it wasn't legal. Although I'm not entirely sure exactly why it's the purview of the librarian of Congress. But there we go. Okay, so moving on here. Samsung's next big smartphone, called the Galaxy S4, will track a user's eyes to determine where to scroll, said a Samsung employee who spoke to the New York Times on condition of anonymity. For example, when users read articles and their eyes reach the bottom of the page, the software will automatically scroll down to reveal the next paragraphs of text. The source would not explain what technology was being used to track eye movements. The Samsung employee said that overall, the software features of the new phone outweighed the importance of the hardware. And I thought that was... I thought that was significant too, is that because what we're talking about here is a breakthrough in mobile devices that watch basically facial recognition and take visual cues from you as to what to do on screen. And on the one hand, it's a little creepy. There is a little bit of a creep factor here, you have to admit, of software that is watching you at all times. And on the other hand, I also think that especially in light of the discussion that we had last week and the week before about Google Glass, that this seems like a step in the wrong direction. Instead of Samsung moving forward with software that is integrated to the body, as Google seems to be moving forward, we're making innovations in software that you still have to, in hardware that you still have to hold on to. I don't know. What do you guys think?
It's really intriguing. I linked an article recently, which was about how Android devices also, how Samsung Galaxy S3 has a smart stay feature, which adjusts brightness based off of facial recognition. So, we've already had the concepts of facial recognition in play, especially on like laptops and now cell phones. Everyone's watching you anyway, so why not add an extra device? I'm really just curious more along the lines of like, is this actually going to just be odd, or will this be smart and function appropriately?
Because you go finish.
All I was going to say is I've never really thought about how I look at a screen. And in this day and age where I'm looking at multiple screens, so I'm switching between my phone and TV, and I just wonder how effective it'll be.
That's more my worry about that. Like that sort of assumes you're always looking at it. And it's a very different form of interaction. Like we're very used to thinking of our eyes as being almost invisible. Like we don't, we feel weirded when people even realize that we're not, looking at them, because we sort of assume that as long as our face is in the right position, that nobody can actually see that our eye is looking out to the right or something. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be really weird, being on a screen and you look at something in the corner and something, it moves, or, it doesn't really bother me as much that the software would be watching me per se. Like, I guess it's a little bit creepy, but I don't know. I guess being on the tech side, I sort of assume that everything is tracking everything I do.
I mean, iPhones are already capable of knowing, they have proximity sensors, so they know when your ear is placed up to it to darken the screen and everything. So it's not too much of a stretch to extrapolate to the phone actually watching your face. But it is, I think it just strikes at sort of a primal creep factor of machines watching you and knowing what you're doing. So,
yeah,
Okay, so let's move on here. YouTube will launch a subscription music service later this year. The service will likely have some overlap with some new features also rumored to be coming to Google's Android music platform, Google Play. Both services are said to be adding a subscription fee that will unlock additional features. For the YouTube-based service, this will likely mean ad-free access. Fortune magazine was briefed on the service by sources in the record industry and at Google, who declined to be named. Through a spokesperson, YouTube issued the following statement: "While we don't comment on rumors or speculation, there's some content creators that think they would benefit from a subscription revenue stream in addition to ads, so we're looking at that." So, this sounds like a good idea on the surface, but I can't understand what distinction. How is this going to be different from YouTube, from just listening to music on YouTube on your mobile device or on any sort of device? I'm not entirely sure what the benefit is, other than to marketers.
Well, YouTube already has that mind share and market share, right? A little bit. When I'm out with my friends and one of them says, "Hey, have you heard this video or heard this song?" They almost always go to YouTube first to find it.
Yeah.
And it's almost always there. A few of my friends who are on Spotify, the sort of early adopters of it, but YouTube has a great place to sort of onboard people if they want to do that. Like, "Hey, you want to listen to streaming music all the time? Why not sign up?" And of course, they can also connect that with their deals that they currently have with the artists and whatnot too. Like, I wonder if this could be another revenue stream for artists. Like, we're basically going directly to those sales rather than having to go through something else. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see sort of where it goes. And I honestly have not heard about that until just barely on the road here today. So I'm a little bit out of date on that, but be curious to sort of see.
I'm also curious to see how they'll implement it too, and what sort of functionality they'll give other than what we're used to seeing from YouTube as a video search platform. Like, are we going to be able to create playlists of music that we like, or will it do some sort of like radio function like Pandora or Spotify, where you just you type in an artist and it'll find other artists that are similar? I mean, certainly Google has the capability of doing that. It'd be interesting to see how that all rolls out on YouTube if they do that.
Yeah, but you clearly see the destination that they're going. It's sort of like an Amazon-esque roadmap where, you know, you not only can you play it, you can now get it from potentially our music store and so forth, right? And they have the user base to definitely do it. Oh, the question is, you know, will they get it right the first time? Because there are already players in the market, and some of them do a pretty good job already. So,
all right, let's move on here. Microsoft violated the terms of its settlement of an antitrust case, says the European Commission, by failing to let users know that they could use a web browser other than Microsoft Internet Explorer on their Windows-based PC. But here's why Microsoft need not care about the 561 million euro fine. According to its latest 10Q statement, the company has $51 billion in overseas cash burning a hole in its pocket. That money represents profits earned overseas, much of it in Europe, that Microsoft refuses to bring home to the U.S. because to do so would to be give up 35% of it in corporate taxes. Granted, Microsoft's going to miss the $500 million that the EU will be extracting from the company, but given that Microsoft can't figure out what else to do with its cash, that may simply be the cost of maintaining market share for its desktop browser. So essentially, the EU fined Microsoft, and Microsoft was like, this is chump change. Let me just, you know, root around in the couch and find your 561 million euros.
Yeah, it's one of the problems. You just simply can't fine a company enough to make a difference. Like, it seems to be like the sort of upshot of an awful lot of sort of these corporate, you know, sort of laws in the recent times. Like, it just, no matter how much it is, like, yeah, it's not enough. And one thing I sort of want to remind people, like, I feel like Microsoft has sort of gone from being like this really terrifying force to something that we just sort of like josh about and make fun of. But I think it's really important to remember, like, in the 90s and early 2000s, when Microsoft was really sort of at its peak, like, they were like a terrifying force and like really, really like anti-competitive, innovation, like really, you know, good at basically taking other companies and other, you know, competitors out there and basically using their dominance in other fields to just totally squeeze them out. And like, I don't know, I really think that like it hurt like that time period that, you know, there was, you know, the Netscape died, for example, or that, I'm trying to think of some of the other companies that they really, you know, killed out. It just, you know, the laws of the court, or the ways of the courts work slowly. And just because they're getting to this like 10 years later doesn't mean that what they did 10 years ago was not something that really deserves a fine of this size.
It's, and here's the other weird part about this whole situation is that there's a report now that alleges that it was Google that tipped the European Commission off to the fact that Microsoft had been had been doing this for so long. So if that's true, then this is, you know, just another example of the, sort of the escalating war between the major tech superpowers of Google and Microsoft and Apple and Samsung and Dell, etc.
So maybe the doomsday clock needs to be reworked into the technological doomsday.
We need a tech doomsday clock. It would be digital.
Of course.
Be 11:59 and 59 seconds. Wow. That's funny.
I kind of want to create the tech doomsday clock.
That's an awesome idea. But what would be the... what would be the catalyst? What would be the the signs of a tech doomsday?
That like when you hit like midnight, what would that be? Well, I think we can look at it from a couple perspectives. Yeah. So I think what we'd probably include would be one, the battling between the companies.
Sure.
In terms of like
patent wars.
Like patent wars, or like Google, or it's implied that Google may have outed Microsoft about something.
Right.
But then we could also look at it too on the and I don't know necessarily if we'd look at it this way too, but you could also like actually there are three methods. The other mechanism you could look at it is in terms of like bugs we have in like Y2K.
Right, like or that. The Stuxnet virus or things that or when something like the PlayStation Network gets hacked.
Yep. And the third thing, which I don't know if you want to think about it this way, but we could also think about it with like crazy technology in terms of, remember when they revived the, was it a sparrow or pigeon? You saw that article, right?
No, I don't. It's not ringing a bell. But yeah, we certainly could take it from the aspect of something like how soon before the robot overlords overtake us? Like how soon before Skynet launches.
Yes. Like,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think there should be, I thought about this earlier this week. We should have a law where it's okay to develop cutting edge, high tech robots, and it's okay to develop realistic artificial intelligences, but we shouldn't be allowed to combine the two. You know, let's keep the robots in the control of humans, and let's keep the artificial intelligence out of mechanical sort of anything that could cause harm to humans.
Terminator sparrows. You didn't hear about this?
No, I didn't. This seems frightening. Let me read this. In a move not far removed from the Model T-101, U.S. researchers have succeeded in reanimating a dead sparrow. Duke scientists were studying male behavior regression among sparrows. They cleverly decided to insert miniaturized robotics into an empty sparrow carcass and operate it like a puppet. It worked. They noticed wing movements were a primary sign of aggression. Fortunately, the living won out this time. The experiment stopped after real sparrows tore off the robo sparrow's head. But there's always a newer model on the assembly line. Good luck, sparrows. Wow.
Like, they were really aggressive during the entire process. I think even in the article, like, if you actually see the article, even when they weren't flapping the wings,
yeah,
they were, like, really aggressive towards that particular one.
So the real sparrows knew that this was not one of them, right? That this was an outsider.
That's what it seems like.
Wow. I wonder if we would react the same for a humanoid android. Basically, the sparrows were reacting to the uncanny valley phenomenon, right? Like, this is a sparrow that looks as close to a real sparrow, but there's something about it that is just not quite right. Like, when you see those videos of robots, like Japanese and Korean robots that look so realistic, but there's something about them that just is the creep factor, once again, is amped up, is pinged. And there's something about it. It's not quite exactly right.
I'm a little confused about with the story is at the bottom it says under male aggression, the living male birds were equally aggressive to robo sparrow, whether its wing movements were activated or not, the researchers found. And then the next line, it confirmed our hypothesis that the wing waving behavior is functioning male aggressive communication. And I'm like, but didn't you just say you couldn't tell? Like, how does that work?
So were they mad at the wing moving, or were they mad at the fact that this weird, creepy?
Doesn't it sound like those last two lines are conflicting?
This is falls for me under the category of things that man was not meant to know.
Exactly. So like, I think a doomsday clock might be an interesting thing to do.
That's a great idea. Let's take a little break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk to you about today is called The Science of Evil on Empathy and the Origins of Cruelty by Simon Baron Cohen. In this book, borderline personality disorder, autism, narcissism, psychosis, Asperger's, all of these syndromes have one thing in common, the lack of empathy. In some cases, this absence can be dangerous, but in others, it can simply mean a different way of seeing the world. In The Science of Evil, Simon Baron Cohen, an award-winning British researcher, who, by the way, is, before you ask, a cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen, who has investigated psychology and autism for decades, develops a new brain-based theory of human cruelty. A true psychologist, he examines social and environmental factors that can erode empathy, including neglect and abuse. The Science of Evil will change the way we understand and treat human cruelty. I thought this was an interesting choice and one of Audible's, one of the books on their best seller list. So I thought, give it a try. Could check this out. In any case, to download that audiobook or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook or any of their other books and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Even if you don't like Audible, you get to keep the book for free. So there you go. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, how will internet service providers' new six strikes law affect you? So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Christopher Bernor and Tosin Onofawakin. Five of the nation's biggest internet service providers last week launched Six Strikes, an ambitious nationwide program to reduce illegal file sharing through a series of increasingly dire pop-up warnings, with sanctions for those the industry determines to be repeat copyright infringers. The system targets popular peer-to-peer sites that assist internet users in sharing content. The internet providers won't cut off anybody's access, but customers who ignore the warnings could find their download speeds throttled back or their browsers disabled from reaching certain sites. Customers who get too many warnings will find themselves unable to access the internet until they complete a brief online course in copyright laws. Customers who want to appeal complaints filed against them by the entertainment industry or other content providers will have to pay $35 to start the process. They must agree to have their cases settled by arbitrators selected by the Center for Copyright Information. And the Center for Copyright Information is made up of representatives of music and motion picture industry associations, plus the five participating internet service providers, AT&T, Comcast, Cablevision, Time Warner Cable, and Verizon. Well, that seems a little loaded to me. We talked about the Six Strikes law when it was first proposed, and when it passed legislation, and now once again, now that it has been enacted, Derek Bambauer, a tech law professor at the University of Arizona, said, "Six Strikes is fundamentally flawed. Part of the reason that users is that users were never at the table. The bargaining parties were content owners and ISPs, and ISPs have very limited incentives to defend free speech or protect against mistakes, especially if all the major competitors are in the system too. No way to vote against the system with your feet. And I mean, that's true. If you also if you only have sort of one choice as an internet service provider in your area, how are you going to defend against that? So
yeah, this is sort of an ongoing problem that we get in the consumer world, where you have a like a large group of consumers who have strong incentives and strong desires, but essentially no way of organizing themselves. Like, it's sort of like, you know, pre-unions, you know, in the 19th century, when the factory workers could all, you know, have their wages driven down to almost nothing because they had no collective bargaining power. It'll be very interesting to see sort of how we get around this, like, because I mean, I guess in this particular case, part of the problem is that, as you said, there's no choice. Like, yeah. So Comcast could decide to only give me dial-up, and I would not have any choice. You know, like, that's all they give me. They're literally my only choice for internet. But I think even in markets where there is a decent amount of choice, it's relatively easily for, you know, the powers that be to cartel together and, you know, pretty much do whatever they want as though they're a monopoly, even though they're not.
Yeah, you know what? I really wish there were more players in the marketplace so that we could have decisions, and so we could have choices and more competition. Because as it stands right now, this is really just a conglomerate of individuals who are trying to choose what's best for themselves, mm-hmm. not necessarily what's best for their customers. Because if they really wanted customer approval, it would have been more than like this closed dealing in which we're informed of what policy changes are going to be, right? There's no openness here. And especially if you look through some of the warnings and things, the statutes they've placed in there, they make it seem as though there is something a normal user could do, a normal customer could do, but they don't really, you know, I have a feeling a lot of this stuff is automated, so there's not really much much you could do against it, right? There's no real action you could take on until you are throttled, and then you also have to pay money to even take any sort of action. So it seems very one-sided.
How frustrating. I mean, they get you either way, one way or the other. You know, you're going to end up paying one way, either $35 or, you know, whatever exorbitant fee someone like a Jamie Thomas just got finished, you know, the sentence that just got handed down for her about and handed down and then reinforced and then her appeals dismissed. So we've talked about this stuff constantly on the show. But, you know, Ars Technica has an article here where they actually post examples of the actual alerts that would be sent out. And in this case, the examples come from Comcast. Like, their first alert says, Comcast, a copyright owner has sent Comcast a notice claiming your internet service from Comcast was used to copy or share a movie, television program, or song improperly. We've sent an email with more information about this notice to the email address of the primary account holder of your household. Click the button below to confirm you received this copyright alert and to close it. And then it gets, you know, a little bit more ominous as it goes on. Like, copyright alert number two says, as we did with the first notice, we've sent an email with more information about this notice to the primary account holder in your household. The internet offers many ways to access content online properly. If we receive more notices from copyright owners about this internet account, the account holder will have to take additional steps to confirm this alert. And number four says, it adds on to that boilerplate little by little. On the next page after you log in, we provide more information about browser alerts and the copyright alert system. Please review this material to learn more. They're fairly sort of benign, And then number five says, we consider this serious. As before, we've sent an email to the primary account holder. If you believe you received this previous alert in error, you have 15 days to challenge the notice through an independent reviewer. If you do not appeal in 15 days, you will receive a mitigation alert from Comcast requiring you to call customer service and learn more about online copyright infringement and Comcast policies and legal requirements. So, I mean, and the upshot is that you're going to get mitigated through these. All I have to say is that for at least for the time being, knock wood, my internet service provider is not part of that that cartel. So, but who knows? All right, let's move on here. Doctors announced last Sunday that a baby had been cured of an HIV infection for the first time, a startling development that could change how infected newborns are treated and sharply reduce the number of children living with a virus that causes AIDS. The baby born in rural Mississippi was treated aggressively with antiretroviral drugs starting at around 30 hours after birth, something that's not usually done. If further study shows that this works in other babies, it will almost certainly be recommended globally. The UN estimates that 330,000 babies were newly infected in 2011, the most recent year for which there's data, and that more than 3 million children globally are living with HIV. If the report is confirmed, the child born in Mississippi would be only the second well-documented case of a cure in the world. This wasn't necessarily tech news, but I thought it was just amazing enough that we just had to give it some attention here, because this is a groundbreaking science, scientific landmark here.
Is there any sort of sense of like what the mechanism was that sort of led to this? Like with the Berlin patient that was highlighted a few years ago, right. They think that he got a bone marrow transplant from a donor who had a resistance to HIV. But I've been sort of trying to figure out, and again, not following it super closely and not super biologically educated, trying to figure sort of what specifically was different about this patient than other, babies that have been treated with HIV, or even other adults have been treated with HIV.
I think there are a couple of factors here. First of all, according to the article, the tests found a level of virus about 20,000 copies per millimeter, fairly low for a baby. And then once again, they aggressively treated the baby with antiretroviral drugs fairly early on at 30 hours after birth. So it may have been the combination of a low sort of existence of the virus and the aggressive treatment early on that reversed this, and hopefully it stays reversed.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting to really see how far we've come in a few years in terms of treatment. Like you said, it will be interesting as they continue to try the same treatment for other new infants and see what sort of results we get. Mm-hmm. But hopefully it's something that we can build up on.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I think it's a great bit of news here. And let's move on to a little bit more fun news here. Our last headline of the evening. George Lucas was asked by Bloomberg Businessweek whether members of the original Star Wars cast will appear in Episode 7 and if he called them before Disney's purchase of Lucasfilm to keep them informed. Lucas said, we've already signed Mark and Carrie and Harrison, that is Luke, Leia, and Han Solo, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford, or we were pretty much in the final stages of negotiation. So I called them to say, look, this is what's going on. He pauses. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that. I think they want to announce that with some big whoop-de-doo, but we were negotiating with them. Then he adds as kind of like a last second aside. He says, I won't say whether the negotiations were successful or not. But I think essentially what he's saying there is that Luke and Leia and Han Solo are going to be in the next Star Wars movie. What do you guys think about that?
Well, my first thought is, wow, they're going to be very old.
Yes.
I hate to say that.
My first thought is, where's Lando?
I'm in complete agreement with you. Where's Lando? I mean, he didn't die in the first series, right? He's still alive, so
yep.
Hopefully, maybe they'll squeeze him in there too. Although I think this is a very nice sort of way, and a lot of remakes of movies like to do this too, where they'll bring somebody in from the original cast to sort of give an official passing of the torch to the new generation. I think this is a nice way of doing this as well, and a way of keeping it in canon and building that connection between fans of the original series and fans of the new series who may not even be aware of who Luke and Leia and Han are.
Blasphemy. Blasphemy.
You say that, but, you know, it's like my daughter, I can't get her to watch the original trilogy. Actually, I can't get her to watch any Star Wars movie to save her life. So she's not a big fan. She watched the first two begrudgingly. I mean, Star Wars 4 and 5 begrudgingly. And I could not get her to watch Jedi. So.
What?
Yeah.
That's unfortunate, kids these days, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, every generation, I think, has their Star Wars, has their, like, big watershed tentpole movie that they remember for the rest of their lives. And for me, it was Star Wars, and I just don't know what it's going to be from my daughter's generation.
You know, I was rewatching those recently. I got a hold of a Laserdisc player and was watching the widescreen Laserdisc.
Uh-huh.
So this is pre-special edition, non-edited in any way. They're really good movies, and they've like really held up, like,
yeah,
like really well. They're fun. They're exciting. They are entertaining. Like, and this is, I mean, something that sort of really stands out when you watch the newer three movies. I mean, there's just a playfulness and a funness in them that is somewhat unique even for science fiction. Like, there's an awful lot of science fiction that is very serious and very dark. And, you know, Star Wars sort of manages to be exciting and fun and bring you good ideas, but at the same time, it's just fun to watch. And I must admit, I'm also really excited. I know you guys probably already talked about this, but J.J. Abrams, I couldn't think of anybody better in the current sort of list of directors out there who would do this.
I'm glad you feel that way, because
don't mention that to Dwayne.
Yeah. Dwayne is not of that opinion.
I mean, the most recent Star Treks were so Star Wars-y. Like, honestly, my biggest criticism of the most recent Star Treks were that they felt too much like Star Wars. So, like, hey, like, that'd be perfect. And I can't think of anybody who I would want to do better. Certainly not George Lucas. Never let him near a Star Wars movie again.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan's too dark. He doesn't have that playfulness. Yeah.
He would be good to bring in on a second movie in a trilogy, like when things start to get really, you know, like The Empire Strikes Back was tonally darker than Star Wars and tonally darker than Return of the Jedi, for that matter. And I think he would be good to bring in on something like that, where you really want to get down and dirty and serious with the Emperor or whomever the villain of the next trilogy is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I think this is great news. I think the big one was Harrison Ford, because he's still a fairly successful, popular actor. I'm not saying that Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher are not, but I think for them it was more like they didn't really have very much else going on in feature films.
Mm-hmm. I think we could you totally imagine Disney just trying to keep it hushed for Comic-Con and getting everyone there and be like, hey, they're all back.
I would expect that you're still not going to hear anything from Disney officially until some big event. Like, I don't know if also Disney's got their D23 conference, and I don't remember if that happens before or after Comic-Con, but that's usually their official when they have big movie events that they want to promote. Now they do it at D23, like they did Lone Ranger, and I think there was a couple others. I think John Carter got the big push at D23,
and I guess I am also kind of jumping the gun because nothing has been filmed yet. There may not even be a full script, so we've still got a while to go.
Well, I mean, nothing has been filmed, but according to George Lucas, it's been in development for a long time, so they must have some sort of idea, at least to where they're going story-wise, if not have something scripted and shot. So, that's it for our headlines, but before we sign off, let's leave you with this week's viral video of the week. So, since 2005, Boston Dynamics has been developing their quadruped robot Big Dog with increasingly more eerily realistic capabilities. Last week, they released a video which shows Big Dog using its arm appendage to grab a cinder block and hurl it behind it, using the strength of the legs and torso to help power motions of the arm. This sort of dynamic, whole-body approach to manipulation is used routinely by human athletes and will enhance the performance of advanced robots. The cinder block in question weighs about 35 pounds, and the best throw that Big Dog gave was a bit more than 17 feet. This research is funded by the Army's Research Laboratory's ARTCTA program in the hopes that it'll be able to serve as a robotic pack mule to accompany soldiers in terrain too rough for conventional vehicles. I first saw this in a Tumblr thread where someone had made a GIF of it and mirrored the GIF so that it looked like the Big Dog was tossing a cinder block behind it and it was being caught by another Big Dog.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So it was some sort of weird sort of like toss and catch situation here. But I mean, what did you think about this? Because there is, once again, we talked about before with the phones that watch you, there is a bit of a creep factor to this because it gets into that uncanny valley where, you know, it touches a sort of a basic primal instinct that machines should not act like humans. And the Big Dog just continuously is having more and more characteristic like humans, and it's just sort of a little creepy.
It looks like something out of like a who's that Spanish artist, Salvador Dali.
Uh-huh.
Like, it just looks like something out of one of his paintings. You can just imagine one of those things with like a clock melting over the top of it or something, you know, like it's not just like in the uncanny valley. It's like digging a hole in the bottom of the uncanny valley to make it deeper. Like, it's, and the fact that it's like throwing cinder blocks just sort of, you know, it's not like, oh, here it is throwing a shot put, or, you know, picking up something, doing something useful. It's like, no,
right.
And it's like, it's doing something like the Hulk would do, just like grabbing something that normally, you know, is sitting there holding things down.
Right. And effortlessly tossing it over its shoulder until it shatters on the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if they, and I say if, with hopefully, because I know that it's going to be when and not if, but when they weaponize something like this, I mean, this would just be absolutely vicious in the field.
Yeah, move the doomsday clock up a notch. But I mean, I think it's pretty also remarkable because it's not like a standing still arm throw. It's this whole body motion. It's like a pitcher, right? There's this full body motion, and it's really remarkable how far they've advanced with the Big Dog. Even from I remember seeing this like years ago when it was just able to walk and move, and it's just it's remarkable what we can do nowadays with technology, you know.
Yeah this especially this company Boston Dynamics, they're with the Big Dog and the Big Cheetah and the Pet Man. This is the first robot company, essentially. This is the first not robot. I mean, yes, robot, but the first sort of humanoid robot company. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, the first projects are going to be in the hands of the military. So it's a little scary. I don't know what to think about this. Anyway, let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Chris. We haven't seen you in a while. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter at CrisBurnor, CHRASBURNOR, where I post the interesting things throughout the week. I sort of taken to just finding my my little tweets and this is what people use Twitter for. I don't know why I'm saying it separately. And then my more longer form stuff is at CrisBurnor.com. And there should be some pretty interesting stuff coming out there. I gave a talk a couple weeks ago up in San Francisco on product development and have been taking the various slides from that and turning them into blog posts, but haven't actually posted them yet. So check them out soon when they come out. And then every Monday and Friday, you can get an email from me and Chris McCann, my co-founder, at startupdigest.com with the best startup-related events in the Bay Area on Mondays and the best startup-related articles of the week on Fridays.
Terrific. Tosin, how about yourself? Where could you find your work online?
You can find me and my ramblings on Twitter at Toast4321, TOAST4321. And you can find me discussing movies and other such things on IRCwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, just Google MrBabyman.com and you'll find all of my social links and everything that I'm doing throughout the week. Also, Twitter.com/MrBabyMan and Facebook.com/MrBabyMan. As for the drill down, you can go to geeksofdoom.com to check out past episodes of the drill down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to Geeks of Doom, and our iTunes link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. And if you like our show, you know, please tell your friends, spread the word. Word of mouth is probably one of the best sort of mediums to get the word across, and we certainly love it when you share our show with other people. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to Stitcher.com, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.